and good evening. It's Panacea, your health program on Tuesday evenings. We'll look at the benefits of horticultural therapy. Talk to Kitsa about her kitchen of brewing for the probiotics. Robots and the workplace, a frightening thought. Stigma around Tourette's syndrome. And finally, we find out coffee is good news again. All that coming up in the next half hour. Tourette's syndrome is a neurological disorder which causes involuntary facial tics and vocalisation. Tourette's affects 1 in 100 school children in Australia. It is more commonly affects the boys than the girls. With no cure and unknown causes, they have yet to be identified. Tourette's acquired a negative stigma which results in children being bullied and socially alienated. To talk more about the syndrome and the negative stigma, The Daily was joined by clinical psychologist Dr. Amy Talbot from the psychology clinic, Dr. Amy Talbot and Associates.
Now, Tourette's syndrome, if we were to be diagnosing a child with Tourette's syndrome, what kind of symptoms are you looking for?
Sure. So Tourette's syndrome is one of the tic disorders, or fits in the tic disorders category. And so really the difference between Tourette's syndrome and the other tic disorders is the combination of the type of tics that the child has, as well as how long they've been present for. So to get a diagnosis of Tourette's syndrome, you have to have the presence of both what's called a motor tic, which is like a movement, so head nodding or eye blinking, facial grimacing, things like that, as well as the presence of vocal tics, so things like coughing or sniffing, things where a noise is made. And if the child has both of those at some point in the duration of their development, and the presence of tics has been there on and off for at least a 12-month period, then that would warrant a diagnosis of Tourette's syndrome.
Mm. What are some of the misconceptions we see around Tourette's syndrome?
So I think one of the main ones is in the media, when Tourette's is portrayed, often it's the more extreme and unusual symptoms that are demonstrated. So things like copropraxia, which is sexual or obscene gestures, things like coprolalia, which is uttering obscene or unacceptable words, so that, you know, the swearing and the loud yelling. And these symptoms actually only occur in less than 10% of individuals with Tourette's syndrome. So they're quite grossly misrepresented in the media in terms of the frequency with which that would occur for someone. And so I think often people, when they think of Tourette's syndrome, that's really what they're thinking of, people who are yelling obscene things unintentionally in quiet environments, and people who are making these obscene gestures. But most people with Tourette's syndrome, although it can have quite a significant impact on their life in terms of the frequency and intensity of these motor and vocalizations, it's often not the way that we've seen it portrayed so far in the media.
You know, it's quite interesting you talk about that sort of portrayal, because obviously if somebody was concerned about their child having Tourette's syndrome, or if their child was displaying some of those rather minor symptoms that you mentioned there, coughing frequently, nodding their head, you would think the child was, rather than suffering from this syndrome, would probably just be a fidgety, coughy little child. You know, if I saw a child like that, my first thought would not be Tourette's syndrome. And yet, I would imagine in treating something like this, early diagnosis would be quite important.
Yeah, so, you know, identifying early on, tics often present kind of in early primary school and when parents report back, so when they've come to treatment at that time, they often report that they didn't recognise those earlier symptoms, but they look back at videos of their children and they see that maybe they had some eye blinking or facial movements that were present even much earlier than they realised that they were tics. And so they often then tend to present later on when the tics are more prominent or more noticeable. And certainly, there's been evidence that behavioural intervention actually changes the pathway in the brain that's related to tic presentation. And so that earlier intervention while the brain is still developing is certainly useful.
Mm. So looking at the ways you treat it, I mentioned there before that there is no cure for Tourette's syndrome,
yeah.
But in these cases that have been diagnosed early, how do you actually go about treating them?
Yeah, so there's a very effective intervention actually called comprehensive behavioural intervention for tics, or CBIT. And what they've shown is that although there isn't a cure, as you said, it's about up to 20% even of young kids can present with minor tics. And then of the people, Tourette syndrome, of the kids with tics, Tourette syndrome is maybe, the one in the 100 that you were talking about. But then of those people, about 60% of them don't go on to have tics as adults. And what we found in looking at brain scans is that the individuals who don't then have tics as adults, they actually have a stronger pathway in their brain between two of the brain sections, the prefrontal cortex and the basal ganglia. And the behavioural treatment that we use, the comprehensive behavioural intervention for tics, it actually changes the thickness of that pathway in your brain and therefore makes it more likely that you would be one of those adults who doesn't have as prominent or intensive or frequent tics as an adult.
So what is your feeling on how we might be able to create a better societal understanding of Tourette's syndrome, one, to help those who might be suffering from the early onset of symptoms to be diagnosed, but also to avoid that negative stigma that we talked about, that kind of social alienation?
Yeah, so I mean, I think education is certainly one of the most important and key factors. So it's actually really great that in line with Tourette Syndrome Awareness Week, we're talking about this now on the radio so that people can be learning about Tourette Syndrome and be more aware of what sorts of things are considered to be a tic, as well as kind of what the experience might be like for someone who has a tic disorder. Often for young people who present to us, we do educational things for their school. So, and I know the Tourette Syndrome Association of Australia does some of that work as well. They do go into schools and provide education about disorders and how to respond so that kids with these difficulties can be really supported. But certainly more education society-wide would be helpful, because I know that lots of older adolescents and adults who still have tics, they often report being very anxious about experiencing their tics in public and the way that other people will respond to them.
Thanks to The Daily, who was joined by the clinical psychologist, Dr. Amy Talbot, from the psychological clinic, Dr. Amy Talbot and Associates.
Sydney Film Festival is now on sale. There's over 350 screenings of 288 films from 62 countries over 12 days in 10 venues. From the magnificent State Theatre in the city to the Ritz Cinema in Randwick, there's bound to be a film and venue just right for you. It all happens from June 7 to 18, and you can buy your flexi passes or single tickets right now at sff.org.au. Sydney Film Festival, proudly sponsoring 2SER 107.3.
Now, we use the process of fermentation to create food which is arguably more nutritious as well as more digestible. That's according to an ex-lawyer turned nutritionist consultant, Kitzer, who joins me on the line. Kitzer from Kitzer's Kitchen from Crow's Nest. Tell me a little bit about how you got into this, please.
Sure, Quentin. It all started when my son was born. He had a lot of digestive problems and he was waking up screaming at night in pain. And we worked out eventually that he was having trouble digesting a lot of things. And in my research, I found that fermented foods have been used in lots of cultures to help digestion. So I started making him a raw version of sauerkraut with lots of live bacteria, and it made the biggest difference, not only to him, but to the rest of our family. So yes, it was one of those sort of things that had been forgotten about that used to be used all the time, and with modern life, it was such an easy panacea to organise, and it made a big difference.
I suppose with this, can people do it themselves, or can they not be bothered and they come buy from you?
Yeah, well, a lot of people tend to buy from me first, so they can see what it's supposed to taste like, because they're all a little bit worried about the process, because it sounds a little bit foreign, a little bit scary. They're worried they're going to poison their families.
Right.
So, you know, they come and buy the real deal. And then we also sell all the equipment to make your own. And we also help people, you know, that are, you know, interested in doing it on a bigger scale. And, yeah, talking to the steps and troubleshoot with them. And then once they've done it a few times, they realise that it's actually not such a big deal, but it's just it was a foreign concept. It just feels really weird. And so most kids like the fermented foods. They tend to crave them. I think they sort of innately know they're good for them. So lots of families have been coming in and learning how to do it with us, yeah.
Now, when you think of sauerkraut, I often think of Germany, but of course you come from a sort of Greek background. Do they use fermentation over there?
Yeah, not cabbage, but they used to do other vegetables that were sort of preserved and left for a long time. They used to pickle their pork as well. So lots of sort of traditional tangy aperitif type of things, like peppers and that sort of thing. But cabbage is actually one of the most healing vegetables when you ferment it because it's so high in vitamin C naturally. And when you ferment something, you increase the nutrients 100-fold. So that's what really gets in there and does a lot of the good work. And, of course, the bacteria just love to replicate in that environment. And you're getting a lot more bang for your buck when you're using sauerkraut than, you know, a combination of other vegetables, for example.
Right. Now this is what, full of, would it be probiotics?
Yep. Probiotics, organic acids, B vitamins, enzymes. So everything that, when they work together, really aid digestion. So whatever you eat with the sauerkraut, it helps to break that food down. So if you've got an issue, say, with breaking down fats or breaking down meats, if you eat sauerkraut with it, it's much easier to digest. And now, a lot of people that don't have a gallbladder, for example, can eat fats when they have sauerkraut with it, because it acts sort of like an ox bile, where it, you know, promotes the bile juices to flow and help break things down.
And is it safe generally, or can we overdo it?
You know, moderation and everything. You can have too much of a good thing. If you do have too much and you do have an unbalanced gut, what will happen is you'll have like a, you know, die-off symptom. So you might feel a bit fluey, a bit tired, a bit grumpy. So the idea is to introduce it slowly, get the gut environment used to all these new bugs, because the more you put in there, the more they squeeze out the nasties. And you want to do a slow process, especially for kids, because you don't want them being put off thinking, oh, that food did something to me and I'm not going to have it again. So you want to do it nice and slow so that everyone's comfortable. And then you don't need to have a lot. They're quite nutrient dense, so a tablespoon of each meal, one or two tablespoons, is more than enough. Like, you know, you wouldn't be guzzling like cupfuls replacing a meal.
You mentioned that you actually got involved with it because of your son. Is it widely accepted that this could actually help with various other emotional issues when it comes to children?
Well, all the newer research now with the microbiome is you know, finally realising the connection between the gut and the brain. And, you know, there's lots of exciting research talking about, you know, how soon they'll be able to prescribe probiotics for specific, you know, emotional conditions. And that's not all just in your head, it all starts in the gut. So, you know, it's still a, you know, a newish area, but there's a lot more research coming out and a lot more mainstream doctors looking at this sort of thing.
Now, I know there's a theory, in fact, that you should be able to keep your probiotics active in the gut without actually having to keep feeding them again. Is there truth in that, or could you actually overdo the probiotics?
Well, you can overdo things because you don't want to create an imbalance. So, you know, having too much of the lactobacillus strain or the bifida strain or whatever you're trying to put in there will then throw the rest of the environment out. And I don't think we know enough yet to know exactly what it should be made up of. So we have to be a little bit cautious because we can overdo things and then throw everything out. So if you've got a gut that's had, you know, lots of antibiotic treatment and there's nothing left when you've been tested, then sure, you know, try and reseed and plant as much as you can in there. But again, don't go overboard and always try and get a balance of different things and a balance of different foods and different probiotic drinks. And if you're taking probiotics, always try and get, you know, quite a few diverse strains in there.
Right.
And vary within the probiotic strains that come from the soil as well. So you're getting that as well into your system.
I'm talking to Kitsa Yaniotis from Kitsa's Kitchen in Crow's Nest. Now, what happens if people want to learn? Do you actually run courses, or how can they go about being taught how to do it?
Yeah, so we're not running any courses at the moment, but we've got a retail store in Crow's Nest called Emporio Organico, and they can come in and see us if they're in Sydney. If not, they can email us so we can send some information. We've got on our website, emporioorganico.com.au, we have all the equipment that you need, all the starter cultures, and we're always having people to ring and get advice on how to get started. We've got lots of recipes we can give people as well. We've even created like our own home fermentation kit called Culture for Life, that helps people create their own at home in a foolproof way, an easy and reliable way, so they don't get into trouble and it all turns out safe and tastes delicious.
So this could be alongside the beer.
Well, beer's fermented, hey.
That's right. Indeed, fascinating stuff, Kitsa. We're talking to Kitsa, and it seems like we can actually do a lot to help ourselves, but in the meantime, we can go off to Crohn's List and learn how to do. Thanks for your time today.
Pleasure. Thanks, Quentin. Lovely speaking with you.
Don't miss your chance to see the final episode of Just Words, recorded live at 107 Projects in Redfern on Thursday, May 18, from 7pm. 2SER is really excited to announce that Jeremy Jones from the Australia, Israel and Jewish Affairs Council will be joining us on the night as a live guest to debate the merits of 18C. Tickets are selling fast, so don't miss out. Buy yours today, and when you arrive on the night, you'll also go in a lucky door prize to win Audio-Technica headphones. Just head to the 2SER website, 2SER.com.
Gardening and tending to plants may seem like a tedious task to some, but to others it can result in an improved sense of well-being and mental health outcomes. This practice is called horticultural therapy and has been utilised by St Vincent's Hospital in King's Cross, Sydney. But not just patients, but also hospital staff. Sarah Wilkins and Fiona Orr from the University of Technology, Sydney, have collaborated on a project to bring more interactive green space to hospitals to provide patients and staff somewhere and something they can turn their attention to for a few hours a week.
I think another thing too was the way their senses were heightened, that they could see things, smell things, the feel of things. So it's really as it relates to the individual and really allowing them, I think, to express personality, parts of themselves, and develop parts of themselves that perhaps have been affected because they've been unwell.
I think it's a sort of slowing down and pausing and stopping and actually smelling that herb and the aroma and do you like it? And oh, well, this one's even nicer, you know, and it will get passed around and things like that. And somebody sent me an article about microbes improving your well-being. Literally, putting your hands in the dirt makes you feel better. There's actual microbes in the dirt that actually enhance your feeling of being okay, which is amazing.
And they talked about how they felt and what they were thinking and what senses had been activated. So each week it wasn't just, oh, we arrive and everyone starts gardening. The group actually got to really know each other, and Sarah and I were also participants in the group. So we were actively participating, not just there as observing researchers. Mm. So we did the 8-week program as well.
Right.
And we saw, you know, the benefits developing in the others who were participating, but we felt them in ourselves too.
What exactly was this program?
The horticultural therapy program that was going on top of this roof of a church hall in King's Cross at St. Canice's. This had been going on before we were invited to it. So it involved people who'd used mental health services at St. Vincent's Hospital, just up the road in Darlinghurst, and they would come down and do this horticultural therapy for 2 hours a week over the 8 weeks. With this trained horticultural therapist. So really we were invited by a contact Sarah had, an engineer, Rob Kaslick.
That's right, yep. Yes. The really nice outcome of our involvement was that we evaluated two programs, and on the back of that, the hospital were able to put forward a case for having facilities on site at the hospital. And we're now currently looking at designs that are being prepared to retrofit 2 or 3 unused rooftop spaces at the hospital.
Right.
So that's going to be fantastic to actually get a real outcome.
I think getting back to the ones we did evaluate at St. Canice's, the other thing that really came up was that a number of the people who were coming to the horticultural therapy were quite disadvantaged. So they often were living in a room in block of units or a house. Some lived in rooms that didn't have a window. They certainly didn't have gardens, and then they certainly didn't have their own plants or capacity to have the plants because of the living environment they were from. And they really, I mean, overwhelmingly talked about it was the highlight of their week, coming to the roof space to see each other, to learn more about each other, the cohesion that happened between the group members. for many, it was, they said that it was the highlight of their week, getting to know other people, making new friends, having connections with others, feeling better, feeling less stressed, somewhere to relax, talking about their mood lifting, and talking about the sanctuary and the haven that they came to each week. In the middle of King's Cross, three flights up, it was framed by a beautiful jacaranda tree and the lovely sandstone church. People just really saw it was 2 hours of kind of protected time for them that they just absolutely love.
In terms of going another step further, and you were talking about implementing them in hospitals, where would you like to see them?
Obviously in sort of hospitals on rooftops and in gardens and being sort of utilised and something that patients can participate in. I mean, in the corporate sector, again, I think Macquarie Bank has got a rooftop garden with chooks on the ninth floor in Martin Place. And I think maybe we should get some chooks on the tower.
Yeah, university.
UTS tower.
UTS chooks.
That was looking at the mental benefit of horticultural therapy with Sarah Wilkinson and Fiona Orr from the University of Technology, Sydney.
2SER 107.3 FM and now digital.
It has been estimated that by 2030, nearly half of the Australian workforce will be replaced by robots. The jobs most affected will be the ones that require no creativity or any emotional intelligence at all. Recently, the non-profit group Foundation for Young Australia reported that 60% of Australian students were training for jobs that will not exist in the future. It also reported that there would be a demand for technology, engineering, science and mathematics. What does that mean to the current students not studying in the field? Miles Holbrook-Walk was joined by the Head of Public Affairs from Foundation for Young Australians, Maggie Hill, who provided more details on the issue.
So is automation a threat to future students entering the Australian workforce?
Automation is definitely a thing and it's definitely a challenge. I wouldn't necessarily describe it as a threat. So the idea that technology is replacing jobs that humans have traditionally done isn't a new one. This is something we've seen over time for a very long time. But we're definitely seeing digital technology becoming increasingly smarter and capable of doing jobs that are, traditionally done by humans more and more. But I think the thing to keep in mind is that as technology evolves and some jobs become redundant, new jobs will also appear, and that there are both challenges and opportunities in sort of this changing landscape of work.
I suppose it doesn't just affect students who are studying to go into these professions. There are already people who may be in professions that are experiencing automation and digital disruption. What are the skills that people, need to learn and to kind of pick up so that they're able to transition into another area of employment?
Yeah, so I'd say there's a couple of things that people can do. We've really identified that it's increasingly important for young people to have a skill set that we call an enterprising skill set, and that is essentially skills that make you more enterprising. So things like being a good communicator, having good digital literacy, obviously, good critical thinking, good project management, those kind of things are going to be increasingly important as our economy evolves. Another thing that we've identified in our research is that young people really need to have a new mindset towards work. So the idea that you're going to have one profession that you train for as a young person and that you're going to stay in that profession for your whole career, that's going out the window. So young people need to have a mindset that they are going to be transferring around a lot and that they need to have a set of skills that are transferable as well. But the other thing that I'd say is this isn't something that's just on young people. Our evolving economy is going to affect all of us. So this is really something that we need to be thinking about across the board. So industry needs to be thinking about it, educators do, parents, the whole works. We need to all have a chat about the impact and think about how we can, be prepared for these changes.
Now, the Foundation for Young Australians reported that the average person will have 5 career changes and 17 different jobs in their lifetime. Mm-hmm. Is there any career longevity in the future? Are there going to be industries where people can work for 30, 40, 50 years in the same job and industry?
Yeah, so our most recent report, the New Work Mindset, really talks to this. And as I just mentioned, that idea of having one job for 30, 40 years, that's going out the window. And that sounds really confronting, but there is a way that you can approach it that's quite empowering. And that's by just understanding that's not no longer going to be the case. And we have identified that by training or working for one job gives you a set of skills that are transferable to an average of 13 different jobs. So what young people should really be doing is considering that I don't want to train for just one job. I need to develop a portfolio of transferable skills that I can use across a range of different industries. And enterprise skills are going to be really important in that skill set. But thinking about what, you know, area of work they have an affinity towards, and just understanding that it's not going to be about having that one job for their whole life. And I'd really encourage young people to have a look at our report. It's called The New Work Mindset. And in it, it identifies 7 clusters of jobs where you can really have that transferability and move around. And it's not just about going to uni after you finish school and then you're going to be ready for the future of work. You will likely have to, you know, update your skill set throughout your career. But I think having an appetite for learning and understanding that that's going to be the future is really helpful in that space as well.
Okay. And I suppose one aspect of this might be, is it wise to change degrees or career paths to something that's in technology or engineering, where people might have the option, if they were able to transfer now, would that be a wise move?
So not everyone's going to need to be a software engineer or be able to, you know, code to a really high degree. Digital literacy is what we talk about as a really important skill, and that's really being able to operate and manoeuvre and communicate really well in a digital economy. And that's, you know, sort of understanding a lot of different aspects about what a digital economy means. And I think young people are already pretty savvy in this space. So I wouldn't necessarily recommend that everyone transfers into software engineering or that kind of thing in their university degree. But I think it's about understanding that, you know, we are in a digital economy. So thinking about the things that you put out there, the way you talk to people in the digital space, that's important, and it's probably going to be there for a long time. And that being able to operate in that digital economy is really important. But again, going back to what I was talking about earlier, it's about having that diverse portfolio of skills and being able to think about how you can apply them in a range of settings is really important.
That was Miles Holbrook-Walks, joined by the Head of Public Affairs for Foundation for Young Australia's Maggie Hill.
Oh, yeah! 2SER1073
Now, we know there's always been a big debate whether coffee is good for us or bad for us, but according to some latest research, it may be potentially quite good for us. Let's discuss this. Turn to a regular contributor, Russell Setwright, who's a practising naturopath in New South Wales. Russell, what's this about coffee helping us?
You know, tea and coffee really are herbal medicines, aren't they, in a way?
Indeed, yeah.
And you know, we seem to say that green tea is okay, but we don't mention black tea, and there's probably some good stuff on black tea as well. In fact, there is. So it depends on how much you have, but the coffee one has got a lot of things going for it. Some things have said that it can help lower cholesterol, and it has positive effects on, well, I suppose a stimulating effect because you've got a little bit of caffeine.
Yeah.
But, you know, so as long as you don't overdo it, it seems to have beneficial effects on the memory. But this is one, they did a big study, and it's published by Harvard Medical School, was put out the work on it, saying that men who drank coffee regularly had far less chance of developing lethal prostate cancer.
Wow.
I thought, well, that's not bad.
Yeah.
You know, so maybe the morning cup of coffee, apart from giving you a bit of a perk up, might be a good thing.
We're running out of time, unfortunately, Russell. We have to visit this one next week. I've been talking to Russell Setwright, a practicing naturopath in New South Wales. You have a really good week. And that music means we're out of time. You've been listening to Panacea on 107.3. I'm Quentin Strawley. Let's make it a date next week. Question of Balance coming up shortly.